So, Jay, can you hear me? Do you have your mic there?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Scott?
I can. You need to let go of the talk button. After you talk like a walkie-talkie, let go and then I'll respond.
Okay. So, all right, good. All right. My question is, in Genesis 1:1, when it says the heaven and the earth, and then in Genesis 2:1, we get the heavens, obviously, because there's a separation there. God's separating. My question is, we talk about devils, and we talk about, was Satan on the earth when he fell? Was there any separation? There's no separation between heaven and earth in Genesis 1:1. So my question is, was he the one who was on the earth with the angelic host, and then he started his trafficking and fell, or was he in the heavenly places? I guess I'm going on here, rambling on, but hope you get my gist.
Back to hands free here. Okay, let me start the recording. I think this would be a good study, and it's a good question. So permit me to hit this record button. And let me restate Jay's question to some extent. I think I know where he's going with this. And it basically kind of boils down to, when did Lucifer fall, if I'm not mistaken? And where was he when he fell? And how does that fit into the scheme of the creation in Genesis 1 and things like that? So that sounds like, okay, good, Jay. I got confirmation from Jay that that's acceptable, reiteration of his question. So why don't we start in Genesis chapter 1? Seems logical there. And oops, I was in another book here. And hopefully the screen is large enough for you to read this. But I'll tell you what I can about this. Obviously, we start to get into the area of some speculation when we start talking about it's a term that I've heard another person use before, but it's almost a misnomer to say eternity past. If it's eternity, there is no time. There's no past or future, but it's acceptable for me. I'll just call it eternity past. And let's read in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. And we see, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. And that really is a complete sentence. I teach this. It's not important that anybody think this is right, or if they disagree with me, it wouldn't have one effect whatsoever on their salvation. But if you'll permit me, I teach that this is creation. Verse 1. It's complete. It's entire. And I reject the idea that creation should be taught like this. And I'm going to paraphrase the way I've heard it in my life. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and here's how he did it. And then in verse 2, they start with, he started with a formless, shapeless mass, and he brought out the light and the water and the thing like that. Okay? I just don't believe that. That seems to be the teaching that is basically the dominant thought in the creationist teaching. And much of what they do say is true, but that part has always bugged me because of verse 2. And I'll get to Jay's question, trust me. It's going to come to light, but I kind of have to start here. It says, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Now, I can't really know much about what that means. It's the first occurrence of that phrase, without form and void, there. And it just looks like there's darkness. Well, it's clear there's darkness, and God brings the light out of the darkness. And there's the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the waters. So I know there's waters there. But as far as we know, all there is a heaven and an earth. No heavens, plural, in Genesis 1, verse 1. Later on, we see several heavens, and I suspect it's the layers or the levels of heaven, as we would. Paul refers to the third heaven, where God is seated, so I suspect there's a second and a first. And it's not important that we absolutely have to know what they are, but I suspect that the first heaven would be the open firmament that he talks about in Genesis 1, where the birds fly. And I also suspect that the other firmament, or the second heaven, perhaps, would be what we call outer space, and that's where the sun, the moon, and the stars are. And you can read Genesis 1 yourself and see all that and figure it out. God will give you the wisdom to see it. But some of the things we can't see so easily, and that is without form and void. There's without even knowing what that means by digging into the concordances and the Hebrew and this and that, it just from the looks of it seems like something that is not perfect, something that is not complete or whole. And yet, everything God makes from this point forward has the appearance of completion. There's no need to go through every single day, but there's light the first day, and it's good. Well, he wouldn't call it good. He doesn't say the earth is without form and void is good in verse 2, but he says the light is good. He creates the firmament and divides the waters above from the waters below, and says that he calls the firmament heaven. And he didn't say that's good either, by the way. There could be something to that that isn't important right now. But then there's a second day. He brings the seas together, and he calls the dry land earth, and he says that's good, giving the appearance of completion there, or like there's nothing unfinished about the earth, there's nothing unfinished about the sea as land and water. Then he says it's good there. He brings forth the grass and the fruit tree and the herb yielding seed and everything else. He sees it's good. The third day ends. You see how the pattern of completion there. There doesn't seem to be anything without form and void in any of this. He talks about making the stars, sun, and the moon there. I'm skipping through. And he puts them in the firmament, and he set them for times and seasons. He saw it was good, and ends the fourth day. Then you've got other animal life that's created, and finally man is created, and he rests on the seventh day. Everything is good. It blesses everything that's good there. And so when you come to chapter 2, by the time you get to chapter 2, look in verse 1, it says, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. Now, did you notice a difference between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 2:1 with the word heaven? I think anybody could see it if they were paying attention. What is that? What was different about heaven in Genesis 1:1 compared to Genesis 2:1? Benoit's got it. It's the S. Heavens, plural. And so I see heavens in the rest of this creative process in the 6 days because of the fact that there's a firmament that is made and it seems to divide waters above from waters below. I see an open firmament of heaven and things like that. So might I suggest to you, if you study this out prayerfully and carefully, that Genesis 1:1 is creation. It doesn't matter when it took place. I do not believe in a gap theory that Dennis Dake proposed that was necessary to explain away millions of years of evolution. I don't believe in evolution. I don't think there's any amount of time that is necessary to be explained for an aged Earth or anything such as that. I don't believe in science, falsely so-called. I believe the Word of God. But what I do see taking place is a creation of heaven, singular, and earth, singular, in Genesis 1:1, and then I see something that happened that shows the earth in a condition of being without form and void in verse 2 of Genesis 1, and then I see these creative acts of God that take place post-Genesis 1:1 that indicate that there's now a plural heavens, and man is on the earth now, and things like that, and man is put there by God to subdue the earth and to have dominion over it and things like that. And so I think about the word subdue, and I think of a military excursion in put down or put under that which could be bad or a problem or something like that. Well, what was bad or wicked or evil in the earth with the animal kingdom or the plant kingdom or anything like that? Nothing I'm aware of. You've got a perfect garden there, the Garden of Eden. God put the man there, and he planted the garden, put the man to dress it and keep it. And you know, we can get into all kind of interesting sort of details about it never rained on the earth, and there was probably a uniform temperature, and you know, all these kind of things. But what was there to subdue? Well, that leads me back to Jay's question. When did Lucifer fall? Because the next thing we know in Genesis 3, the serpent beguiles Eve, and Adam and Eve sin, and sin enters into the world and death by sin. So let's go back and look at that phrase, without form and void. We'll compare it one more time in Genesis 1, 2. And let's use the Bible and see where else it occurs. So I've got Genesis 1, 2, and the earth was without form and void. Now, I don't think it's necessary to go through the Hebrew and say the word was is became and on and on and on. I mean, it might be helpful to look at that, but I don't know Hebrew. So I have absolutely no authority to make that kind of conjecture. I understand I can look up the phrase without form and void, and it's something I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it looks like tohu vabohu or something like that in Hebrew. And that's only useful to me to find where else it occurs, and we can look those things up in a Strong's Concordance. So let's look at the only two other places that I'm aware of in the Bible that the phrase without form and void occurs. And the first one is in Jeremiah chapter 4. And we're just going to compare Scripture with Scripture. Pass it right up. Jeremiah chapter 4, and I think it's about verse 23. We'll find it and we'll read the context. Verse 23. And let me state offhand that I don't necessarily believe, I've taught this before, so if any of you have ever heard this, let me correct myself. I taught this that it is pointing back to the same time period, and it might be, but it might not be. I can't know that. I cannot know that. In other words, is Jeremiah getting a vision that looks back to Genesis 1, verse 2? I've said in the past that it was. It may not be. This could be a future time of God's wrath, so I'll have to leave that open for discussion for another time. But what I do know is whenever this is, the same phrase is used, and there seems to be the appearance of God's judgment. Look in verse 1 of Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 23. I beheld the earth, and lo, it was without form and void. So there's our phrase. That's what we're looking at. Now we read a little further to get some insight. He says, and the heavens, and they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens were fled. See, that's where I get some of the problems of saying this is Genesis 1-2 because of the fact that there's heavens plural, there's birds of the heaven fled, there's no man, you know, things like that. But it's a topic for another discussion that we can have maybe some other time. I'm more interested in the divine judgment here. Look in verse 26. I beheld, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness, and all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of the Lord and by his fierce anger. So regardless of anything else I can glean from the passage, in the context of the earth being without form and void, it is connected to the presence of the Lord and his fierce anger. So there appears to be a judgment that has taken place here. Now, let's look at another passage where the same Hebrew phrase that is translated without form and void is used. I think it is Isaiah 34. I'm kind of looking at my Bible for notes that I've written about this a while back. And yes, it is Isaiah 34. And I apologize, my throat is still kind of recovering from this flu bug here. Much of the context of Isaiah 34, in fact, a lot of the context of Isaiah in general, is God's wrath and anger and judgment. Verse 2 even says, Isaiah 34:2, "For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them, he hath delivered them to the slaughter," and on and on. And I suspect this has to do with the Battle of Armageddon and things like that. But, and that is probably the context of the whole chapter. But if you come down to verse 11, as in connection to this wrath of God destroying, look at verse 8, I'm sorry, Isaiah 34:8, "For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, and the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion." Just a little more context. He talks about the land being turned into pitch in verse 9 and brimstone. And he says in verse 10, it'll be burning. There in verse 10 it says, "It shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever from generation to generation. It shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. But the cormorant and the bittern," I think those are birds, "shall possess it. The owl also and the raven shall dwell in it. And he shall stretch out upon it the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness." Now, there's something interesting about that phrase, because the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness is the same Hebrew phrase, however you pronounce that thing, tohu, bohu, whatever. It's the same Hebrew phrase that was translated without form and void in Jeremiah 4 and Genesis 1. The line of confusion and the stones of emptiness. And I'm not saying it's a good idea to go back to Genesis 1, 2 and plug in, "and the earth was the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness," but it is the same idea. So it gives us a little better understanding. Again, also, we see in Isaiah 34 that that phrase is used in connection to God's wrath, or what I call divine judgment. So if I go back to Genesis 1, 2, and I plug in what we've just gleaned, and I'm not saying it has to be this way, excuse me, Genesis 1 and 2, but if I heaven and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and by the way, darkness is connected as well to, I'm sorry, Mary, I apologize for the problems there. I hope you can, you might try logging back on and you might get a better signal. I hope the rest of you are not having too much difficulty hearing and understanding the breaking up of the sound. Good night, Mary. Anyway, if I plug in the thought of God's divine judgment here, then I have to ask myself why. Why would, if it's so, why? Hey, Kurt, good to see you, and Jennifer. Why would God create the heaven and the earth? And, you know, according to another passage I'll turn to in just a moment, God created the earth to be inhabited. And I don't see how anything could inhabit something that's without form and void and covered in water. You know, so I get the impression there was a divine judgment that took place here. And man has not been created yet. So we sort of have to ask the question, why? If God was angry in the other places where without form and void are used, and there was a judgment that took place, it's very plausible and likely that the same thing occurred here. And I'm not saying it has to be, but for the sake of argument, we can at least posit the idea that he was. Then we have to ask why. What could have happened that would cause God to be angry with his, I'll call it, original creation of Genesis 1:1, And events occur in which we find the earth without form and void in verse 2. Well, let me share that verse of scripture that I was just talking about. I think it's Isaiah 45. So let's go back there. Let me have a chance to glean down. Well, 45:12 of Isaiah says, "I've made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens and all their hosts have I commanded." But that's not what I'm looking for. There it 5:18, still in connection to God's creative act, it says, "For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it, he created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else." So God didn't create the earth in vain, and yet we see the earth without form and void in Genesis 1:2. And I'm not saying that means vain, but if we tie in the idea of confusion and judgment and things like that, then I would get the impression that all God's ways are perfect and past finding out and that kind of thing, but he wouldn't need to start with something imperfect and then take 6 days to make it perfect. But it would make a lot of sense if he created something perfect to be inhabited and not in vain, and yet something occurred that caused it to be without form and void, in which God then took 6 days to bring out of that without form and void condition the world that we now know post Noah's flood, which is something later. Well, then it comes back to dealing with the question at hand about Lucifer, and we might begin to find some answers when we look at that. You can go to chapter 12 of Isaiah, since you're already in the book, and we'll read, of course, about Lucifer so we can get his name and see the only place that the name Lucifer is used. Isaiah 14, I'm sorry. It's verse 12. Isaiah chapter 14, and we'll see verse 12 in a moment. But first, let's do this, because there's an interesting thing to note. Yeah, verse 4. Isaiah 14, verse 4 says, "That thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon." And if you know anything about the Antichrist and Babylon and how they all sort of tie together, you will begin to see that this is in connection to the devil and his plan and his Antichrist and things like that. But then he mentions him by name, and he says in verse 12, Isaiah 14:12. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but let's read it. "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell to the sides of the pit." So Lucifer, whoever he was called Son of the Morning, and he said in his heart he will ascend above God, but he's going to be cut down and brought down to hell and to the sides of the pit. So the ultimate end of Lucifer is this. And I've actually heard a person one time say they don't know who Lucifer is. You know, they can't prove that he's Satan and things like that. I don't have any problem proving that the devil was Lucifer. Because first you see an individual here who obviously cannot be a man himself, though he is in connection to him being the Antichrist. But he's also an angelic creature, and we can go to Ezekiel again to see that, and it would be Ezekiel 28. So let's compare some verses again. Ezekiel 28. And we'll start in verse 1, Ezekiel 28, verse 1. I'm going to read a good bit of this, so there's no need to highlight it all. Verse 1 says, "The word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, say unto the prince of Tyrus, Thus saith the Lord God, because thine heart is lifted up, and thou said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas, yet thou art a man and not God, though thou set thine heart as the heart of God." And I don't need to read all of this, but notice God there was a capital G. And this is a picture of the Antichrist. He's called the Prince of Tyrus. And Tyre, of course, at one point was in the kingdom of Babylon, Assyria. And the Antichrist is known as the Assyrian oppressor, the Assyrian prince, and things like that. But if we scroll down, look with me in verse 11. Ezekiel 28 says, "Moreover, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus. And the king of Tyrus seems to be a little prince. The prince of Tyrus, I believe, is the Antichrist. The king of Tyrus is the dragon, Satan himself. And you'll see there's something different about this guy. And I'll tie it into Lucifer here. And remember that Lucifer means son of the morning or brightness. And, you know, from the word, the Latin word for light, which is lux, L-U-X. Excuse me. So let's read again, verse 12. Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus. And say unto him, thus saith the Lord God, thou sealest up the sun, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering. The sardius, topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire. I'm just listing. The emerald and the carbuncle and gold. So it's a beautiful creature. Seals up the sum of wisdom and beauty. Covered in precious stones. He says the last part of verse 13, the workmanship of thy tabrets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou was created. He's a musician. And then verse 14 really brings it home. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth, and I've set thee so. Thou wast upon my holy mountain of God. Thou wast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Now, I've heard arguments that this was the serpent in the garden. Because they say, thou hast eaten the garden of God. So I've heard people try to say that Lucifer fell in the garden, that he was this anointed cherub, and that's where he said, I'll ascend above, and God turned him into a serpent or something. I don't buy that. Don't buy that at all. I see something much bigger going on here. So I see this anointed cherub, and look what he says in verse 15. In other words, the Eden of God, I don't think had to be limited to the one that he put Adam in. There's no reason. We see the garden of God in the end of the Revelation. So it's not gone. God planted it on the earth. He could have had it with him in heaven before he made the earth. You know, it's his paradise. It's what he enjoys. So if he put the Garden of Eden on the earth, and he's going to do it again, the fact that the anointed cherub was in it at one point wouldn't limit him to having to be as the serpent in the Garden of Eden on the earth in the day of Adam. He could have been in the Garden of Eden prior to Adam even being created, and I do believe that he was. Nevertheless, he is the anointed cherub, and in verse 15 it says, thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created till iniquity was found in thee. So we begin to see a comparison here with Lucifer and the king of Tyrus. I believe it's the same individual. It is Satan. And the iniquity is what caused him to say, I will be like the Most High, I will be like God. And isn't it interesting that his prince, the Antichrist, the prince of Tyrus back there, is going to say the same thing, I am a God, and that type of a deal. So let's continue on, and we begin to put a picture together that gets kind of interesting to me. Verse 16, still talking about the king of Tyrus, or by extension, Lucifer. And it says, by the multitude of thy merchandise, they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and thou hast sinned. Do y'all know that Paul says the love of money is the root of all evil? And here we have something called merchandise. And I know that God talks about his riches and glory, and the city that comes down from heaven is decked with gold and precious stones and all this kind of thing. I suspect, you know, Lucifer wanted more than he was given, even though every precious stone was his covering. But it says there was merchandise and he sinned, there was violence. And think of that. If we can place this fall before Adam, in other words, in between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, and there was violence, well, that would make sense because there would have been a battle in heaven of the angels that joined this anointed cherub in rebellion against God. I know there's going to be a battle in heaven in in Revelation 12. So why couldn't there have been one in the past, in which Satan was cast out of God's heaven as Jesus Christ said in the book of Luke, I beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven. Right? I think it's in chapter 10. I might be wrong about that. Look what he says in verse 17. Thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. The word brightness, Lucifer. He says, I will cast thee to the ground, I will lay thee before kings, that they may behold thee. So he's going to have the same end as Lucifer does back there, and the Babylon king and everything else. And then look in Ezekiel 28:18. Thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries by the multitude of thine iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic. Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of thee, it shall devour thee, and I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold thee. So this is being fulfilled in the beast, in the Antichrist, but Satan is in him. The dragon enters into him at some point during the tribulation. And it's the same guy. It's this anointed cherub. Well, 18 really poses an interesting thought. He says, thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries by the multitude of thine iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic, and traffic ties back into merchandise. Traffic means commerce. So Lucifer somehow trafficked in lies or something. And when did he ever have sanctuaries? When did the anointed cherub have sanctuaries? And where were they? And if you go back and look at that thing we studied in Isaiah 14, it talks about every precious stone being the covering of the king of Tyrus. Of Lucifer. The king of Tyrus in verse 13. Interesting that the number 13 is there. And what do we know in the Old Testament had a similar type of covering with precious stones? Does anybody know that? Anybody want to venture a guess? I know the city of New Jerusalem. Well, that's right, Jay. The high priest wore an ephod. The priest's garment. That's exactly right, Kevin and Sharon. And I don't think it's too far out of line to reason from that, that Lucifer may have been a type of priest, because I know that everything that God told Moses to build concerning the temple and the tabernacle and everything else was to be exactly like the pattern he showed him, because it was a shadow of heavenly things. So while Solomon may have built a temple on the earth, there's a temple in heaven, see, that it was a pattern of. It was a shadow of. So why could it not have been that the anointed cherub covered the throne of God somehow, and he was maybe in charge of or directing, and perhaps even the music minister, if you will, of the worship of God by who? In other words, where were these sanctuaries, and who would have been worshiping God? And for that, we can go to the book of Job. And let's go to the book of Job. I think it's Job 38. Yes. Look in Job chapter 38 and verse 1. And even though this is not talking about creation as the Lord talks to Job, he refers to creation in his statement when he says, verse 1, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Okay, so he's talking about creation. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Verse 5. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Remember that phrase we looked at? Without form and void, and one of them was translated the line of confusion and the stone of emptiness. Well, God stretched a line upon the earth when he laid the foundations, but what if something happened that caused it to be confusion later? And then look what he says, still talking about his creation, verse 6. Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, talking about the earth, or who laid the cornerstone thereof, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. You know who morning stars and the sons of God are, right? They're angels. You see, God laid the foundation of the earth here. So he's talking about laying the foundation of the earth. He cannot mean Adam. He cannot mean the sons of Adam. And 1,000 years later, when man began to populate the earth and they shouted for joy when God laid the foundation, they weren't there. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. I suspect it was in that order. So if God created the heaven, he would have created the host thereof. The sons of God, created beings. And the morning stars, references to angels, often they're called stars. And so I can see in my mind, not visually perfect of any stretch, but I can imagine God speaking the world into existence. And as he did so, and it came there a perfect world to be inhabited, not in vain, the angels shouted for joy. Hooray! They watched him lay the foundation, whatever. He did this thing, and they just were, they stood in awe of his majesty as he laid the thing out and put it all together. And what would they have been so happy about anyway? Well, how come it couldn't be that he created it for them to inhabit? The sons of God and the morning stars. They shouted for joy. Great, this is going to be a place that we will bring forth the praises unto God. And so they created sanctuaries, and they built them or whatever. And Lucifer maybe presided over the worship of God. And he began to get jealous. He looked at how the angels worshiped the God, the Creator, and he went, man, I want a piece of that action. I want in on that. Why can't I have that worship? I'm beautiful. I'm wise. I've got every precious stone. I've got built-in pipes. How come they're not worshiping me? And perhaps he began to traffic in something. Perhaps he was selling something. I mean, what on earth would possess a third of the stars to follow Lucifer in rebellion? And I'm making reference, of course, to Revelation 12. We know that they're fallen angels. We know that there are the sons of God that had to give an account of themselves to the Lord at one day, and Satan came among them in the beginning of Job, Job 1 and Job 2. So I put all that together, and what I see is a Satan, a Lucifer, an anointed cherub, who decided he wanted to be God. He began to sell positions, if you will. Because how do you convince an angel that witnessed God lay the foundations of the earth, knowing he's the Creator, to join you in a rebellion against him? What could you possibly offer? He knows you're not God. He knows you didn't create the heaven and the earth. So what could you offer him to join you and be a part of your evil plan? Well, what if he offered you, I'll make you a god, little g? What if he says, you know, come follow me and you'll be Zeus and you'll be Apollo and you'll be the host of heaven and Moloch and, Nimrod and Semiramis and the queen of heaven and this and that and the other. And that's how come the serpent was able to say to Eve, thou shalt not surely die, but in the day thou enterest thereof, thou shalt be as gods, knowing good and evil. And who were they anyway? I believe she could have looked up and seen the gods talking about Eve. And so he must have offered them something, but whatever he did, it was merchandise, and he trafficked in it. And then God saw that, and he said, I can't tolerate this. I can't allow this to continue. And bam, a flood comes and destroys whatever Satan did to pollute and corrupt the world, the earth, that he originally made. Because there's darkness there, next thing you know. Go back to Genesis 1, verse 2. He created the heaven and the earth, and then the earth is without form and void, and darkness is upon the face of the deep. And God is not darkness, he's light. His wrath has darkness, though. Woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord, for it is darkness and not light. The day of the Lord is the vengeance of God. There's darkness on the face of the deep because of his wrath and his anger. He brought forth the flood. That tells me that the flood of Noah was not the first flood, global flood on this earth. And no, I don't believe that the gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2 had to be millions of years so that monkeys could turn into men and things like that. Some men turn into monkeys, in my opinion, by the way they act and behave, animals. But I don't care if the time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 was 15 minutes. That's all it would have taken for Lucifer. And remember, this is eternity. There is no day. There's no sun and moon. There's no 24-hour periods yet. So it wouldn't have taken any time for Lucifer to spread his lies and convince the angels to join him in rebellion, the one-third that did. So we're talking about eternal things. There's no timeline involved here. There's no issue about trying to fit evolution in that. It's just the fact is something happened between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 that caused the earth to be in a condition that was not fit for habitation. And there's water all over the face of the deep. And since God used water in a divine judgment later on with Noah, would stand to reason he could have done the same thing before that. Not until he told Noah, I will not again cover the earth with water, can we be assured that that won't happen again. The next time God renovates the earth, it will be with fire. And so I believe and teach, as you can see, that Lucifer fell somewhere between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, that he became the serpent, the dragon, the seven-headed dragon of Revelation 12. He's Leviathan. He was there to tempt Eve. And when God says to Adam, subdue the earth and have dominion over it, I believe he meant subdue it from Lucifer, from the satanic forces that were out there. That would bring his kingdom under dominion. And of course, Adam failed. And he sinned. And the redemptive process of man began to take place when God said that the seed of the woman would bruise the head of the serpent. And then we get into the Lord Jesus Christ and everything else. And it comes full circle by the time we get to the book of Revelation, because we see a new heaven and a new earth. And the garden of God, Eden, is there again, and everything else. Only this time there's no more Satan, no more dragon, no more beast, no false prophet, no more sin, no more death, no more hell. By the time we get to Genesis chapter 21 and 22. I'm sorry, Revelation chapter 21 and 22. So hopefully that will at least begin to give you some insight into what I see in the Scriptures. And again, so much of it almost has to be speculation because God didn't reveal that much about it. But I know that Paul said in Ephesians chapter 6 that we wrestle not with flesh and blood, but against principalities, powers, spiritual wickedness in high places. Now, let me be clear about something. I do not believe in Clarence Larkin's teaching about a pre-Adamite race of men who, when they died, they were drowned in this first flood and their souls became the disembodied spirits that are demons and things like that. I can't prove that, and I can't condone that teaching. I'm not sure what unclean spirits are, but I suspect they have to do with fallen angels. But as far as I'm concerned, the only thing inhabiting the earth prior to Genesis 1:2 would have been the sons of God and the morning stars. And that's because they shouted for joy when God laid the foundations of the earth. And the indication of sanctuaries being there and things like that all seems to point to a worship of God through the sons of God until Lucifer came and corrupted it. And you can take that and study that out and compare the Scriptures and pray that the Lord give you some wisdom and insight. And if you see some things that I'm missing or I don't see, I'd love for you to share it with me. Now, does anybody have another question or a follow-up question from Jay? Is there something else that we can discuss concerning these things? Well, but you look over here and see if the question mark is up. Are you all still able to hear me? Hopefully you're there and we didn't lose the forum. Oh, good. Okay. Thank you. It's reassuring to see that sometimes. I know that Mary had trouble and she had to leave because the sound was breaking up for her too. Nothing else? Anybody want to share anything or add some insight to that? Thanks, Macy. I appreciate you joining us. And be in prayer about something, everyone. I may go ahead and add an additional night, Wednesday night, for Dim Dim. The attendance at my church on Wednesday nights is so low, and I'm not complaining when I say that. It's just that's what it is. And I know that some of the folks that do come have already talked to them, would be happy to do the forum. So I'll keep you posted about that when we do make that decision, but we may add Wednesday night as an additional Dim Dim study. Okay? So just pray God give us wisdom about doing the right thing. It would be 7:30, Macy. It would be the same time here. And so hopefully that'll be something that you can join. I know that the Friday afternoon study isn't feasible for some of us that work and that type of thing. And that's for the benefit of those in Europe especially. So Wednesday would give another opportunity, two at least, opportunities for online studies for most everybody that does have an evening free. So we look forward to seeing what will come of that. Okay? Anything else from anyone? Oh, you know what, Jay? Thank you, Gert. Let me see if I can grab that right quick. I want to get you the link to that site about the Unity Conference in Orlando. If you'll bear with me, I'm going to look through my bookmarks to see if I can find Brother Jerry's website there. Rats. If anybody knows this, let me know. Let me do a quick search. I bet I can find it. I can picture his website in my mind. There it is. I bet the gracebiblestudy.net. Okay. Let's do this. Coming events. That's it right there. All right. I'm going to post a link right quick here. And that link will take you to the details about the Unity Conference there, okay? Now, Mike, let me read what you wrote there. Is it fair to say that God created time with the Word? I'm required to have movement from one place to the next, later to the next place, later? Yeah. Very interesting thought, Mike. I couldn't disagree with that. I can't say that God created time with that Word because it doesn't say that He did. But I know that as He was there, something began to take place where He said, let there be light, and He said the evening and the morning were the first day. So certainly time began to be recorded there with that motion, if you will, with that creative act or that movement. Yes, and so in that, by extension, you're right, the gap would have been before time. In other words, I don't use the gap to prove that there was a bunch of time. I say if there's a gap, it's not because there was time. It's because some things occurred that caused the earth to become in a condition that God needed to bring the light out of the darkness and that type of thing. So, yeah, I think that's an excellent point you've made. Very good. Yeah, and I never thought about the word move, but you're right. We move through time. But I guess, you know, God has moved prior to time, too, so you can also make the counter argument, you know, that God's not limited in any way. So while we are certainly limited physically by being able, we're temporal, we have to move through time, but God's eternal, and yet He moves regardless of time. So making time be connected to His movement wouldn't necessarily negate eternity. But that motions of Genesis 1-2 do seem to begin the time clock when there's a day, and I believe it's a 24-hour day when He says that was the evening and the morning were the first day. So that's good. That's a great observation. I like that. All right. Anyone else? Well, excellent. I am very glad you were here tonight. Oh, I forgot to stop my recording. And I appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I hope the word's a blessing to you. I hope you'll study it out. Check out the things I say and compare them. And don't take my word for it. Let the word of God teach you. And show me where I mess up if I do.